Welcome to Sleep Junkies. I'm Jeff Mann. We cover the whole conversation on sleep. So unless you've been living under a rock for the last few years, or you never listen to or read the news, you'll no doubt have heard about how our technology gadgets, our smartphones, our tablets, our laptops, emit a certain kind of blue light, which is very disruptive towards our sleep. Now, this is all true. But when we're talking about how technology can impact on our sleep, sometimes we tend to focus on the blue light issue and ignore equally important aspects such as the types of media we're consuming, timing and behavioral issues, the addictive nature of social media feeds. All of these things are mixed up together and sometimes quite hard to separate. So that's what we're going to do today. I'm talking to a world expert in behavioral sleep medicine. We're going to rewind back to the beginning of time and discover exactly why light is so vital to our evolution and our daily function. Then we're going to fast forward to the 21st century and discover why technology is so intrusive on our sleep and our circadian rhythms. But we're also going to give you some great tips if you're one of those people who just can't keep the phone out of the bedroom. Now, this episode was recorded before the coronavirus was announced and before we all went into lockdown. But I imagine a lot of people are spending a lot more time in front of screens these days. So hopefully you'll get some great information here. Quick shout, if you're liking what we're doing on the podcast, don't forget to leave us a review. Head over to our Facebook group, Sleep Junkies Worldwide. Get in touch. Let us know if there's any sleep-related topics you want us to cover. That's it for the intro. Let's get on with the show. Okay, well, good evening for me and good afternoon for our guest. Really excited. On the other end of the line, we've got Dr. Michael Grandner. Hi, Dr. Grandner.
Hello.
And today we're talking about a topic. It's really heavily covered in the media. We're talking about the effect of digital media and screens on sleep. Before we get into the discussion, a brief introduction. Now, I feel I can legitimately call you a rock star in the world of sleep because you were featured in Rolling Stone magazine about a month ago. I'm not going to go through your CV and your credentials because it's a list as long as your arm, but you're a behavioral sleep medicine specialist. How do you describe yourself at dinner parties?
So at dinner parties, I say, I work at the university. That's usually helpful as far as it goes. But no, so I direct the sleep and health research program here at the University of Arizona, and then also the behavioral sleep medicine clinic where we see patients.
Great. I've just got your bio page on your website, and there's about six paragraphs here saying what you do. So that's a very neat summary. Well, let me ask you just briefly, what was your sort of gateway into sleep? What was the earliest sort of interest and got you on this path?
Because sleep is cool. So when I was in high school, I thought dreams were the most interesting thing ever. When I got a job, a part-time job, it was at the bookstore. It was at the mall bookstore back in the day when those still existed. And whenever we got a book in on dreams, I would always read it. And I thought it was the most interesting, most fascinating thing ever to learn about how these work. And so that got me into learning about sleep stages and REM versus non-REM and other aspects of sleep science. So here I am, like this high school junior and senior, reading about, you know, sleep stages, thinking it's the coolest thing ever as sort of an intellectual exercise, because I just thought it was fun to read and read about until I was in college and I had a friend who had gotten a job as a tech in the sleep research lab on campus. And I didn't know we had one.
Okay.
And I thought that was the coolest thing ever, that one, that this actually existed, like right where I was. So I wanted to learn about it. And the guy who was one of the people who ran that lab, he ended up teaching a course in sleep for undergraduates the next year, which was an amazing course. I mean, that was, you know, Michael Perlis's sleep course. And anyone who knows him knows that he's an amazing teacher. And so I was just really lucky that I was there in the room to have Michael Perlis teach me about the history of sleep and dreams. And it was the coolest story ever. And I just remember thinking, man, what a crazy cast of characters and all this great stuff that they found, and it's still ongoing today. And like, I really want to be a part of that story. Like, this is where I belong. And so I volunteered to work in the lab, and you know, two independent studies and an honors thesis later, I was applying to grad school and you know, went from there.
Well, thanks for that. Well, let's get into the subject. So a little bit of historical context. Now, everyone's aware that we live in a world of artificial lighting. And I'm sure before we all had electric lighting, you know, things were much simpler and maybe sleep was a bit more straightforward. But in 2007, a guy called Steve Jobs walked onto a stage and announced the invention of the iPhone. Now, I just did a quick Google before the conversation, and apparently 3.5 billion people own a smartphone now. So it legitimately changed the world in lots of ways. Now, around that time as well, a company called Facebook introduced a feed, which is kind of a never-ending list of stories and events and news and updates. And we kind of put these two things together, and we ended up with a situation where everyone got hooked to their smartphones. That included people not wanting to go to sleep because they wanted to look at Facebook and Twitter and all the other social networks. And we have this explosion in digital media, this term addiction engine, which I really like.
And that's a great one.
Yeah, that led to lots of, well, an increased interest in the research community about, are these things delaying us sleep? How are they delaying us sleep? Because there were lots of people reporting they were getting less sleep because of screen time. That's kind of where we are now. But the reason I'm really interested in talking to you, Dr. Grandner, is because the main thing we hear about this story of screens and sleep is the effects of blue light. And I wondered if you could give us a sort of a précis of this biological mechanism that causes screens to disturb our sleep. And then we can dig into some of the other factors that are less talked about and less explored, because it kind of needs breaking open, this topic, a bit, because it's not really as simple as screens emit blue light and blue light disrupts our sleep. So I wondered if I could hand it over to you there.
So the way the system works, in a nutshell, that we have the external environment impacts how our internal environment sets rhythms. But to understand that, you kind of have to take one more step back and think about, why do we have rhythms? And evolution figured out very early on that trying to do all biological processes simultaneously at maximum speed is not efficient for survival. I mean, you're not born sprint your entire life and then die. And if you do, your life will be short. And so one of the things that evolution figured out was rhythms, that there's a time and there's a place for things to fall in line with each other. And for a complicated system to work properly, timing becomes very important. And timing things to go together becomes very important. And, you know, an amazing thing about pretty much all life on Earth, except down at the bottom of the ocean, but pretty much everywhere else, we are exposed to this light-dark cycle. And, you know, if you think about it, going back billions of years, that, you know, dinosaurs came and went, ice ages came and went, Pangea came and went, but the one thing that has never changed is the light-dark cycle. It is highly predictable. It is highly influential in that it changes your environment dramatically, especially if you are any kind of biological system that involves vision or using light for and heat for energy, which most systems on Earth do. They use one or the other. Even plants are using the light. So developing a biological system that that harnesses this idea that there's light and that there's dark, there's a day and that there's a night, just makes sense from an efficiency standpoint, which is why the machinery for these 24-hour cycles goes all the way back, where you can see this in microscopic organisms even. So so this idea that we live in on the Earth that spins around on its axis and goes around the sun, and we have this light and dark environment. Well, rhythms are important, and here's a rhythm that's highly predictable that we can start building systems around to make use of. So for example, if you're an organism that uses light for heat and energy, maybe the biological systems that harness heat and energy should be more functional during the day and reduced at night for efficiency's sake. So fast forward many, many millions of years, and you have the system that we have, where we have all of these systems that operate on cycles. They may not have needed to be 24-hour cycles, but because that's what the light-dark cycle is, and so many things handle light and dark, and day and night, that a lot of rhythms in our body are built around the 24-hour cycle. The 24-hour cycle becomes a rhythm that the whole body can use. So because of that, programming in all of these systems at a 24-hour cycle would be really convenient. Unfortunately, nature doesn't work that way. Nature can't program an exact 24-hour cycle in all organisms all the time. I mean, it's a biological system. It's messy. What we have actually is a brilliant piece of engineering where if you're trying to measure a length of string that's going to be exactly 24 hours long every day in billions of people throughout the entire history of human existence, how do you make it so that those lengths of string are roughly the same all the time? You can't program in an exact string length. So what we do is we have a system where most people, their internal string, their internal rhythm actually isn't 24 hours. It's a little more than 24 hours. It's close, but it's slightly more.
Yeah.
And it's almost always more, which is important. Because if you want to, if your string manufacturing makes strings of varying lengths, but they all have to be exactly 24 hours long, what you do is you create strings that are always a little more, and then you trim the end. You know, that way it's easier to trim the end with a little bit of extra than to come up short, because it's hard to add. So we have this natural 24-point-something hour rhythm. For most people, it's probably between 24.2 and 24.5 hours. It's a messy system. It's not perfect. It's genetically determined, not programmed. So, but it's almost always more than 24 hours. If it's less, you've got a problem, and that's very rare. But it's usually a little bit more. And so what happens is when we get to the end of the 24 hours, we snip the end and start all over again. And the way we do that is by essentially resetting the clock. Now, it's not quite that simple. We're not just getting to the end and cutting the line. What we're really doing is as we're going through our day, we're trying to take our internal clock and combine it with the information we know from the external environment to see, all right, I know this internal clock isn't perfect. How do I modify it? Where am I in the 24 hours? Am I about right? Am I a little off? And so it's constantly making adjustments. So it's looking to see from the environment where in the 24 hours it is, knowing that it has a pretty good guess, but it knows it's not perfect. So the main input, not surprisingly, based on the context I was just talking about, is the light rhythm. So for most of human existence, and you know, if humans have been on Earth for more than 100,000 years, farming was invented 10,000 years ago. And society and civilization is about that old. So for most of human existence, we lived in an environment that was very bright during the day, very dark at night, and we lived relatively close to the equator where the seasons don't change very much. And so that's the system that we were sort of built for. We're also highly adaptable and can go all around the world and all of these things. But at the end of the day, we built ourselves over all of this time a system that assumes the day is bright, the night is dark, and that it should be relatively constant. And that information will be incredibly useful to reset our internal clock. And it's not just that the day is bright. So a lot of people know that, you know, you have rods and cones in your eyes. So the rods are these things on your retina that tell light and dark and how intense light is, but they don't have color. And closer to the center of your retina are more of these cones. And you have three kinds of cones. You have red, green, and blue, and they tell color. So light is measured in wavelengths, in nanometers, from peak to peak on a wave. So where the peak to peak of the wave, where it has a high frequency light, then you have different color. And as the frequency changes, the color changes. And so the cones in the eyes respond to certain frequencies of light better than others. So the red cones respond to frequencies in the red spectrum better than all others. So when it sees red, it sends signal. And so the combination between the red, green, and blue cones mix together to sort of create the color that we see. Yeah. So we have these rods and these cones, and the cones respond to a certain frequency range. Frequency range just meaning color. So there's a third system in the eye, and it's not rods or cones, but they also have a very specific frequency range. And their output is not to the vision centers. It doesn't go to the place where we see. It mostly goes to the clock. So this is the clock's main input from external light. And these cells have a very specific frequency range of light that they're looking for. And it just so happens that their peak is right around 480 nanometers of a frequency. And it'll go to, and the range is variable, but 480 nanometers. If I was going to show you what that color frequency is, it would be like a teal or an aqua color. It would be a greenish blue. And those cells respond to that greenish blue color better than any other colors. But it also, they'll respond to things that are near it, just not quite as strong. So most blue light will trigger this response, and most green probably will also. But like red and orange don't really hit on that at all.
Sorry to break in there, but I just wondered if you could expand just slightly on that, because everywhere we hear about blue lights, but we're actually, as you describe very eloquently, it's a bluish greeny light.
Right.
So why don't we hear more about the effects of blue green light rather than blue light? Why is the focus so much on blue that we hear about?
I don't know. My dissertation was green. But no, honestly, so the reason I think we hear more about blue is that the peak sensitivity covers more of the blue than the green. So like super green is probably might not be quite in it as much as the very blue. But to be totally honest, I remember when all these discussions were happening, and at first it was short wavelength light was what it was called. And it was everything in that frequency range that wasn't ultraviolet, but it was sort of in this blue-green sort of range. And then they would call it blue-green light. And all of a sudden, everyone started talking about blue light. And I'm thinking to myself, did we forget about the green part?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, then the products were on the market patenting the to be a little less cynical, I think that there were some studies that showed that a purely blue light might have done better than a purely green light. And so when they tried a couple different frequencies, blue worked really well, and people like blue. Blue is also a little more efficient because it takes less energy to produce some of the blue than the green. So maybe, I don't know. But really, like in my mind, it never stopped being blue-green light. Yeah. Unless there's something I don't know and there's some literature I didn't follow up on. But in my mind, like, yeah, there's a lot more on blue, but there's no reason that green isn't involved too. It's just people sort of forgot that green was part of the story too. But that goes right into what I was saying, is that the fact that it's the blue into the green is really poetic when you think about it, because what is the range of light that evolution in our eyes figured out is day, is daylight? It's the like exact color of sunlight through seawater. It's the ocean. It's the sky. It's the natural world.
Yep.
I mean, I'm in Arizona where it's very brown sometimes, but right. Much of the rest of the world, you know, if you're outside and you're not anywhere near civilization and you're where this system evolved, like the external world, there's a lot of blue and green. That's daytime. And
yeah,
that's the frequency of light that our eyes know instinctively is daytime. It's blue and green, especially blue green, that ocean, sea, Mediterranean sort of color. That's the color, that's the perfect color for telling us, yes, this is the world, this is day.
Yeah.
And so up until very recently, the only time we ever saw that color with any kind of brightness was during the day. And the other colors like red and yellow, if they were bright, they were, you know, that was dawn, that was dusk, that was fire. That really wasn't daylight. And we, without thinking, know this. And our clock knows this, mostly. And so light's the main input. Yeah. So we have this system where we have a 24-hour plus whatever rhythm that wants to be 24. So it's using information mostly from light to guess where in 24 it is to keep it to 24. Light being the main input, blue-green light being the most important, and white, you know, to harken back to high school physics, white has all of the frequencies in it. Mm. The main reason white light is important is white has blue and green. If you take all the blue and green out of white light, it won't have nearly the same effect. And we're going to talk about that later.
Love it. Brilliant. I love the zooming out and zooming back in on this. So we've established that, you know, we've got this very, very strong cue for our clocks, our body clocks, our circadian rhythms, short wavelength light. Now, this, you know, as I mentioned earlier, this is kind of what's talked about as the main culprit disrupting our sleep. We'll talk about some of the other aspects in next. But we've also got variables within that light itself. So as we talked a little bit about the spectral range, you know, going from blues through to greens, but we've also got the brightness of the light, the distance from the light source. These are all very important factors as well. Just a brief aside, there's this sleep aid gadget you might be aware of to entrain your breathing. It actually projects a blue light. So I'm kind of thinking, well, hang on, isn't blue supposed to disrupt our sleep? But the light is actually very far away from your face. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on these aspects? You know, so a screen is going to be very close to your face.
Right. The first thing is the distance of the light to your face. So, so you're exactly right that when you have a light source that's right up to your face, that it's all about how much light is hitting your retina. So if you have a light that's on the other side of the room, much of those photons have dispersed around the room. Some of them find their way to your retina. But when you have a light source that's right there, those photons have nowhere else to go. And so they're all going straight into your eyes. So, you know, you can have a television on the other side of the room is going to have much less impact than even a relatively dim mobile phone right in front of your face, because the light has nowhere else to go. It's at the end of the day, it's all about how much light is hitting the retina. The retina is assuming that the more bright the light is that's hitting it, the brighter it is. It's not trying to guess. It's not correcting for how far away the light source is. So when you have a screen that's right in front of your face, you're going to be more sensitive to it than a screen on the other side of the room.
So it's simple, really. If we can imagine
seeing these photons come out. your retina is being bombarded because they're less dispersed because the light source is that much closer to your face when you're in front of your tablet or your phone as opposed to a TV.
Yeah, so that's why that's important.
Yeah. So that's the light. Now, one of our previous guests, Professor Michael Gradisar, he's done quite a lot of work in this area and actually casting quite a few doubts on the actual importance of the blue light itself and saying, well, hang on, we know about these biological mechanisms of blue light, but when you're in front of your Facebook feed or whatever it is these days, TikTok, you've got a whole range of psychological processes going on. Arousal, the term has been used. And also, another real obvious thing when we're talking about screens and sleep is if you're on your tablet or your phone, you're not sleeping. So you've got this idea of displacement. So I wanted to get your take. We've got like a moving target here. The light is obviously having an effect, but we're also, you know, excited about what we're looking at on the screen and stimulated. And these things, these platforms are designed to kind of hook us in. And also the more we're on them, the less we're sleeping. So what's your take on how the effects of these different variables are weighted? There isn't really a consensus as far as I've seen. You know, people have got differing views on how important these different aspects are.
So we know how blue light, blue light impacts sleep through two things. And I say blue because I mean blue, green light in general. The system of light impacts sleep two ways. One, because it sends a daytime signal when you might not want a daytime signal. And the second thing is it just biologically suppresses melatonin, which might also be helping at night as well. But in a real world scenario, life is complicated. It's not just about the light. You know, most people, when they're in their living room at night, it's not very bright. Even if they have a screen on, it might not even be that bright. They might be watching TV on the other side of the room. And even if they're on their phone, you know, maybe the screen is dim. And so at that point, the light might not be the thing. It's also the impact of light is different based on the time of day. So if you're at a time in your day when your brain is looking for, is it daytime or nighttime? Light is going to have more of an impact if it's present where it's unexpected. So, for example, if it's the middle of the night and it's been totally dark for a long time, and then all of a sudden you turn on your bathroom light because you have to go to the bathroom, if it's 3 or 4 in the morning, you know, that bright light coming out of nowhere where it didn't belong has a much bigger impact. Then you might have a harder time falling back asleep, for example. Then, you know, it's 10 p.m. versus 11 p.m. and you know, your room light is still relatively bright and you're also looking at a computer. That's not the same degree of impact. So in a real world scenario, this impact of light on sleep depends a lot on how much light and where you are and what else you're doing and all these other messy things. And I think that these other factors having to do with the stimulation and as well as the time displacement, I think those are as important, if not maybe more so, for most people. For some people, they might be more light sensitive, and it might be more about the light. And the light is certainly a more attractive scientific story because it's less messy, it's easier to study, and the biology is more easily worked out. But I agree that these other factors are just as important. I have to say, I'm a huge fan of Michael Gradisar's work. He's done some actually really fun and interesting studies in this. Every once in a while, people congratulate me on his work because our names are similar. But I actually do really admire a lot of the work. He's actually been one of the main voices putting forth this idea when talking about light was all that everyone was doing. And he was like, hold up a minute here. He actually did this amazing study back, you know, I don't know, it's probably more than 10 years ago now, where he took a bunch of, you know, young adults. I think it was, I don't know if they were college students or about that age. And they're like, all right, you're going to either play Call of Duty or you're going to watch March of the Penguins. The screen is going to be the same difference from your face, same amount of light. Which one's going to keep you up more? No surprise, it's the video game. And it was a really fun study, but it was really eloquent in that it showed when you, even if you control for the light exposure and the timing and all this stuff, there are these other ingredients that are really important. And they're really two separate things. One is the arousal, where these systems are made to hook you and to keep you hooked. And so like you have these endless feeds that just keep going and going. There's no end. So like you can keep going forever, and it's going to keep trying to entice you with new things to keep your attention, whether it's for ad revenue or just because they want to be interesting, whatever. A lot of it can be very eye-catching. And there's, you know, people talk about clickbait and people talk about all this stuff, where at the end of the day, it's supposed to be snagging your eyes and your attention. It's not there to make you bored, to put it down.
Yeah.
The other thing is the time displacement. You were right in that the main issue is when you're on your device, you're not sleeping. And for everyone listening, I'd want them to think about a time when they're watching a show or a movie, and then they maybe watched a couple episodes of a show or something, or playing a video game. Video games are the worst for this. And then like hours went by and they barely noticed. We're like, holy crap, it's 5 a.m. Or, you know, I just watched 3 episodes. Now I'm like an hour later before I wanted to go to bed, but I barely even noticed the difference in time. And what happens is when we're that distracted for something that's continually reinforcing, that we lose time. And we live in a society where we're already complaining that we don't have enough extra time, especially for sleep. So now what you did is you just gave it up for nothing. You were already short and you gave it away. You gave it away to something that didn't actually give you anything or any benefit, but you lost sense of time. And part of what happens is because you're so distracted, you're not noticing your own internal bodily sensations. You're not noticing the environment.
Yeah.
So you're not noticing that it's getting darker. You're not noticing that, you know, your body is starting to wind down. You don't notice that you're getting sleepy until all of a sudden you turn the show off or whatever. And now all of a sudden you realize, oh my gosh, you're really thirsty and you have to go to the bathroom and you're really tired. Because all of those signals have been yelling at you for the past hour and you weren't paying attention.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes complete sense to me. I mean, life used to be so much simpler. If there was a series you really liked, you tuned into one episode every week. Now, if there's something you really, really like, I mean, last Christmas, I pretty much binge watched all of, you know, 7 series of Game of Thrones because I was late. I was late to it. And I just found myself doing exactly what you're saying. And it's like, oh God, I really need to find out what happens next. And before you know it, you've watched 5 episodes and it's 2 or 3 a.m. These things never used to be around. And also these clever, recommendation algorithms they put into all of these social media platforms now, and YouTube included. These things never used to be around. But I also just wanted to mention a couple of bits of research that came out recently, which are related. Some really interesting and relevant research coming out of Monash University in Australia again. I think the figures were, there was up to a 50-fold difference in how sensitive people were to these effects of light, which is incredible, really. Just like we're sensitive to caffeine, into individual differences, there's huge variation in how people are sensitive to light as well. So some people are going to be able to tolerate these effects much more than others.
Yeah, I mean, that was a study. So the first author is Andrew Phillips, and there were some other great people on there, Elise McLashan, Claire Anderson, Shantha Rajaratnam, Steve Lockley, and the senior author, Sean Kane. It was a great study, and it really, I mean, it would be really convenient for science if we were all made in a factory and we were all identical. However, going back to the evolution bit, evolution figured out a long time ago that that's not actually good for survival. You know, if you don't have diversity, if you don't have variability, if you don't have randomness and mutation in the system, you become vulnerable for extinction. And humans are extremely diverse. You know, we are very complicated organisms. And if you've seen one, you've seen one. And for especially a system like this, there's a lot of room for variability. But I think we know this, where some people, they do just fine living in Canada or Scotland or other places that are a little further north that go without sunshine as much. And they do fine. Yeah. Where there are other people who are miserable if they don't get to see much sun for a couple months out of the year. And for decades, we've used this term seasonality to describe that sort of a thing where some people were prone to seasonal affective disorder. Some people were not. And, you know, some people, you know, they stay inside for too long. They just get, they get all bummed out and they lose all their energy where they need sunshine. Or other people are much more comfortable and flexible in that way. It seems like there's this distribution of seasonality and how sensitive people are. And because we've known that for decades, I'm not surprised that there's actually huge variability in how people respond to light, even on a biological level. This is, you know, you're talking about a very messy system. It would be great if we knew exactly how to reprogram people with light pulses, but it's complicated. And because people are complicated, you know, which means my job as somebody who studies behavior and context, I mean, it means I always have work to do because nothing is ever solved. The only thing we can do is get a step closer to understanding a layer of complexity. But I think it's important for people to know that sometimes in the media, in order to tell a story that makes sense, you have to make a lot of assumptions in what you're saying, and you have to remove a lot of context and nuance. It doesn't mean the nuance doesn't exist. It just means it's hard to tell a story when you have 18 commas and qualifications before you can actually say anything.
Yeah.
But the truth is, life actually is complicated. And anything you're reading, like, well, this is good for this, this is bad for this, just assume that if you ask the researcher who did it, they would say, yeah, sometimes, and it depends. And what it depends on is actually the fun thing to study, and how does it depend, and how, what do you do about it? But that it depends, I think, is a really important message for people, that they're like, oh, all this stuff is crap because I sleep fine. It's like, well, maybe you're less sensitive, or maybe you are and you just don't even notice. But I think it's important to note that there is this variability.
Absolutely. I think nuance is the key, and dogma is the enemy. You know, sleep science is evolving all the time. And I think I heard the lead author who said, Sean Kane, mentioned that there may be in the future some ways of some kind of test to see how sensitive we are to light, which would be fascinating.
So is there variability? Yes. So the scientific question that I think is interesting is why? But then also the other important scientific question is how. So what drives the variability? Is there some molecular pathway that determines how, like, so maybe light triggers, you know, the light at these melanopsin containing cells. Maybe there's some metabolite of melanopsin that some people are more efficient at processing than others. For example, I don't know. But finding out what's some of the machinery behind why the variability exists, and then A, you can test for it, but B, we might be able to modify it. So if you're somebody who's highly sensitive to light, but you know your job just moved you to, like, I went to college in Rochester, New York, like, which is why I went to grad school in San Diego, because I had enough of not having sunshine. So, like, right. Let's say your job is moving you there. And is there a way to make you less sensitive to light, for example? Or maybe, or at least a test to find out if you're a good candidate for that sort of a position, or are you just going to be miserable, for example?
Fascinating. Watch and see. I'm sure in the coming years we'll have more discoveries in that area. Just going back to this idea of different types of media. So we talked about social media. We talked about YouTube. You mentioned gaming as well. Now, you know, it's pretty obvious that watching funny cat videos is going to have a different psychological effect on you to playing an 18-rated horror-themed shoot 'em up. But we often lump all these ideas of digital media in together. What do we know about, you know, the existing research out there at the moment about the different effects of different types of media?
Yeah, so video games seem to be the media that has the easiest time with this time displacement, because it's highly engaging and interactive and active, and you're thinking and you're interacting with it and you're doing things with it. And especially these days, it can keep going and going and going. And so that interactivity itself can be self-perpetuating, as opposed to something that's a little more passive, such as watching an episode of television that you don't really have much control over. And then you have things like social media and browsing the internet, which are sort of in the middle. You have a lot more control over what's going. You can contribute. You may be getting feedback. And so there is a bit of a spectrum. The other thing is, the thing about TV shows is that they have a start and they have an end. So sometimes it's good to, you can actually put a limit and say, okay, I'm going to watch this episode. And then maybe 5 minutes of the next episode, but then I'm going to turn it off. As opposed to a video game where, like, if you, you know, maybe it's getting to some objective or something, but a lot of time these days that can take hours. So because yeah. they're trying to make the gameplay more immersive, more value. I mean, because games are expensive and they want people to spend as much time in them as possible and invest time into them. So I would say if you're walking into a buffet with unlimited refills, you have an internal barometer of there's only so much you can eat. It's probably more than you should, but at least there's a failsafe. Like there's at least some point where your body's like, no, you're not eating anymore. And at that point, you've gone way past what you probably should have done anyway, but at least there's that. As opposed to some of this media consumption where we never evolved to have this issue. So we don't have a fail-safe, a safety net, a backstop that says too much, except when you're so sleepy you fall asleep. That's sort of it.
Yeah.
And
it's the ultimate
and
fail-safe.
By that point, you sort of, again, you went a little too far.
I just want to round up on, you know, a bit of a positive note.
Yes.
Because, you know, we don't want to give the message that it's all doom and gloom and that, you know, we're destined to become victims to these nefarious tech companies trying to steal our sleep.
And often they're not even nefarious. I mean, they're trying to, some of them maybe, I don't know. But I'm the kind of person who likes to give the benefit of the doubt that people are doing the best they can with what they got. And people don't do things because they're trying to hurt people. I mean, I think people are, game companies are building games that they think people are going to enjoy playing. You know, media companies are trying to put out media because they think people are going to be interested. You know, but at the same time, it's not that they're the enemy. You know, it's like food companies want to make food that people are going to enjoy eating. But no food company is going to have a commercial that says, you know what you should do? You know, we make candy bars. You should eat 30 of them at once. They don't say that. There's a whole world out there of stuff that is built to be attractive and hooking and addictive. And it's meant to keep your attention. And what you need to do as an individual is know that going in. Like, know going, walking into the buffet that you're not going to eat everything. You don't plan on doing that. You know, you're not going to live there forever. You want to go there for what you want. And you want to think ahead of time of set your goals. So when you're binge watching a show, what you would do is say, all right, this is when I want to go to bed. I'll set a timer, or like I'll watch 3 episodes, but then I got to promise that that'll be it. And when you don't, you note that and you say, look, why aren't I doing this? And that's where the behavior side comes in. And that's where the cognitive stuff comes in, where it's not just about the biology. But no, we live in a complicated world and this isn't going away. And we just need better tools technologically, but also emotionally and cognitively to deal with the world we live in. And I think we can.
Yeah.
I think we definitely can.
Yeah. And I also see some of these tech companies, I would argue it's all happening too slowly, but, you know, but they're putting in controls to limit use, you know, for children, for instance.
Yeah.
You know, so it is happening. I think it's probably happening a bit too slow, but these things are going into place. But I just wanted to run through a few of these things that people could do.
Sure.
Blue blockers. Maybe we need to remarket them. Blue green blockers, glasses. A lot of people talk about Flux and Night Shift and these applications that dim your screen. not having the phone in the bedroom. A recent podcast, Dr. Valerie Crabtree said she takes all of the phones from her teens and puts them in the kitchen, and just literally doesn't let her kids have the phones in the bedroom. There are lots of things we can do. Are there any others that you use as common recommendations?
So I've got two things that are a little different. One is, if you're the kind of person who needs to be on your phone to help wind down to get into bed, and then you're in bed on your phone, and you want to cut down your phone use, I have one very simple suggestion that you're not going to like. That instead of being on your phone in your bed, you stand next to your bed on your phone. And if you need the phone to wind down, great. But the thing about standing is, you're standing, and so eventually your legs are going to get tired, and they're going to send a signal that actually you're tired and you want to lie down now. So that's when you put the phone down and you lie down. So if you're laying down in bed with the phone, you're comfortable, and it's much easier for you to lose sense of time that way. But when you're standing, you're going to put that phone down much faster. You're going to realize you actually didn't need it that much. You actually really do want to lie down. And so that's one simple tip that everybody hates, but it's shockingly effective. Another tip that everybody hates, but is shockingly effective. I learned this from a patient who had terrible insomnia and was on their phone at night and had a hard time putting their phone down. And what they did was they went into the accessibility section on their phone, and there are these color palettes that you can use. So they changed their color palette to grayscale. And so the entire phone was in black and white. And she found that it was much easier to put down where there were no bright colors and the videos were all in black and white and photos were all in black and white. And she said it was much easier to put it down at that point. It was very frustrating, and she turned it off as soon as she could once her sleep got a little better. But it was extremely, I mean, first of all, cutting out blue light, there's some white in there, but really it's that stimulation that it shortcuts. Those are two very simple things that people can do with screens. Like I said, they'll hate them both, but they're actually really effective. One is standing instead of sitting and laying down if you really need that phone. It's like, if you really need that smoke, okay, you're going to go into this box out in the cold where you're going to do it if you really need it that badly. Or turning all the colors off on your phone in the accessibility section. I think both of those are useful tips that will actually work, or might actually work.
Yeah. I like the color one in particular. That's a great tip. I love that one. Thanks so much for your time, Dr. Grandner. Give us a quick rundown where people can find out more about yourself. You're very active on Twitter, and I highly recommend everyone to follow you on Twitter. I don't know if you're available on any other of these platforms.
I'm very active on Twitter because it's fun, and I get to talk to people. And that's where we met. You and I met on Twitter, and we've talked a number of times. So for people who are interested, I have a website, michaelgrandner.com, where people can find out more about me. I've started putting together an email list because it's 2020, and that's how people communicate now. And going to try that. And so I'm going to start putting some stuff out there. I would say between the website and Twitter, I'm easy enough to find. If you Google my name, even though it's hard to spell, I'm relatively easy to find. And also, I do want to say for the people who are listening, I tend to be pretty responsive. I'm not the kind of person who I'm too busy and important to talk to actual people. Like, no, I get emails all the time from people who say, hey, I saw you speak once 3 years ago at this thing. Or I saw you talking on this TV show about sleep and I had this question or whatever. And I'm happy to answer any question as best as I can, or can you clarify this? Or what do you think about this? And, I feel like, in life, we're all in this together, right? And there are some things that I can do to help. And there's a lot of things I'm not that good at, but this is one way I can help. And if I can help, you know, feel free to reach out, ask me a question. I'm around.
Let me just sort of blow your trumpet once before we leave. I mean, there's a very famous person out there called the sleep diplomat, but I think you should be the sleep diplomat, because a lot of the time you get some flames going up on Twitter. I always find when you intervene, you're giving very balanced views on both sides of the argument and providing the nuance. And I think it's quite refreshing on social media that, you know, a lot of people stick to their guns and they won't budge. But when Michael Grandner comes in, it's like, well, yeah, you've got a point. And you've got a point, but there's also this as well. So, you know, I think maybe the sleep ambassador, you know, you could be.
Yeah, I take that as high praise. So he is a friend, and I respect his work a lot. And I feel like that's sort of my role, where it's like I'm a sleep person who knows as much as I can about this stuff, but I'm also like a human who like lives out in the world, and like, all right. Like, where are you coming from? So what in this, you're not wrong, and you're not wrong either, but like, okay, where can we come together on this, and where's the actual issue? Yeah, no, I take great pleasure in that, because I like seeing people get along, and, you know, I'm for keeping the conversation going. This isn't politics. We're not calling each other names. Yeah. We all have the same goal, and we're all on the same team, and I think as long as we remember that, it's more fun to build connections and relationships with people than to foment frustration and be superior and be right and like, oh, they're, you know, putting people down. Like, I don't got time for that. I think this is way more fun, because there's so many cool people out there doing really cool things. Not all of them are things that I totally agree with, but most of them are coming from a good place. And maybe if we all work together, We'd be the rising tide that lifts all the boats.
That's a brilliant note to end on. Thank you so much for your time. And hopefully we can come together at some point in the future and crack some of these other nuts in this in this world of sleep.
Looking forward to it. Yeah, you know where to find me.
You've been listening to the Sleep Junkies podcast. Hope you enjoyed this episode. We'll see you on the next one. Sleep well.